Under the skin. Hi, welcome to Under the Scales. I'm here with Philip Zerbo, who actually is in Colorado. Where in Colorado again, Philip?
I'm in Lakewood, which is on the western edge of Denver Metro, right over by Red Rocks.
Okay, and I think we're about to uncover that the band Phish has directly affected your life.
Indeed.
And we're also going to find out, and this is the reason that you're that I'm interviewing you now, is that you've indirectly, I believe, and possibly directly, affected a lot of fans' lives without their knowledge necessarily. Much like a friend or a colleague of yours that I interviewed formerly, David Steinberg, kind of was the, you know, unseen, unofficial statistician. Philip is involved in the Mockingbird Foundation and is directly involved with this wonderful book that I'm holding right now called The Phish Companion, Volume 3, which came out mid to late 2016. Is that right, Philip?
Our printer was in Minneapolis, and the book came out on the day that Phish was in Minneapolis, and so we had someone actually like run books over to the band. It's cool.
So for those of us who aren't as versed as you are on set lists and remembering dates and stuff, when was that?
It was in June. You know, okay. It's funny, but I would fail the Phish trivia stuff so bad. You wouldn't
I don't think so.
You'd think I'd be the walking repository. But June-ish.
Okay. Right? Okay. So you're not one of those like super set list savvy people?
I probably know a lot more than I think I do, but maybe it's just by comparison. I know people who are like, who can recite chapter and verse, and I've just never been one of those folks, you know? But,
it
sticks out. I'm probably better than Trey, not as good as David.
I'm going to give you an opportunity to speak for all the jaded vets, because you are definitely a jaded vet. And
I'm a vet.
Phish just announced the Baker's Dozen. So they're going to play 13 shows in July and August of 2017 at Madison Square Garden. Kind of their first large residency like this that I know of anyway. And remember, you're speaking for all the vets. What do you guys think about this? What do you think about it?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think that as a class, I've never actually been asked to speak on behalf of the jaded vets. But I mean, if anything, the jaded is a joke. First of all, I think it's really important to kind of put that out there explicitly, because it's a term of endearment in like among each other. And, it's also used somewhat divisively and aggressively when folks are sort of displeased with some matter of opinion that emanates from us, right? It's like, the jaded vets. Baker's Dozen, I think it's awesome. what wouldn't be awesome about it? I think that the length and the location and the just doing something that is fundamentally off the beaten path from what they are sort of expected to do and have done is awesome, and it opens up all kinds of doors. And it doesn't really even, if they do, like a lot of people were talking today about, what could they possibly, what could they do that would be different and interesting and unique, right, in that sort of framework that wouldn't be otherwise possible. And, maybe they're going to come up with something awesome. Maybe it's going to be 13 kind of, regular-ish shows. But it's great. I mean, does anyone not think it's great?
Well, that's a good point. I think the few complaints that I have seen or registered anyway have to do with New York being very expensive, but also, doing this instead of a tour is kind of not fun for some people. For me, New York's in my backyard. I was thinking maybe you would have some sort of complaints about the fact that they're not doing a tour and they're doing this instead. However, if there's anything that I've gleaned from all your kind of prefaces to Phish's various eras in your book, The Phish Companion 3, it's that Phish is unpredictable and loves changing things up. And so for that, we have to love it.
I get the fact that, I mean, that the sort of provincialism of, you know, wow, well, you know, it's very expensive to go to New York, or I live in Washington, or I live in California, or I live wherever it is. And people, you know, everyone wishes that they could have lots of readily accessible shows, or it's that, or they don't have a tour. Right.
If it was one, if it was not having a tour or not doing anything, of course, people would prefer this. To me, I think it's like it. I think it sets the stage for a very, no pun intended, freeform sort of playing. And I'm not sure really what that is or if that really will even happen, but almost like they could kind of do the middle sections of the 13 shows anyway, very experimentally is what I'm kind of feeling.
Oh, I think that would be amazing. And if you look at it in terms of an arc, right, an extended event, right, rather than like 13 kind of 3-hour events.
Yes.
Then it just, you know, like, wow. I mean, I would love to. And I've always kind of wondered why, you know, like maybe some nights the band comes out and it's like it's in a particular mood, right? Like maybe they're particularly bummed out because of something that, you know, that isn't great. Maybe they're particularly psyched. Maybe they're particularly sort of, you know, rambunctious, or maybe they're particularly kind of, you know, calm and introspective. And the ability, like I've always sort of wondered why that doesn't kind of permeate shows more holistically, right? And I think that the answer is because, you know, that they look at each show as an individual event at which people might be coming for their only time that they're seeing fish in a particular period of time, right? Well, maybe the only time they're going to see fish ever. And so that they have sort of like not a formula, but essential elements of the fish experience that they want to convey in every show, right? And I totally understand that. But I think that when you look at something like this and the possibilities it opens up, and really understand that the vast majority of the people attending these gigs in particular are going to be looking at it more from the arc, right? It's not going to be like a bunch of individuals. You know, people are going to be really paying attention closely to the sort of to the ebb and flow and like what the you know, what the run does as a whole.
That's exactly right. I think people like you were talking about sort of the implied bargain when you go to a show, fish, despite whatever they might be feeling, they shed all those feelings and adopt the persona of fish. And I think also the overriding emotions of just being on stage and performing allow them to forget whatever those feelings are. But the bargain with the audience is we're here to put on a great show. What if there's sort of no bargain? What if it's like you guys are here with us for these 13 shows, you know, and who knows what happens in the middle there, or you know what I mean? I think that's kind of what you're driving at, and that's kind of that's why I'm excited about it.
Sure. Well, I mean, it kind of goes back to like the long gig, right? I mean, we've done that once, but they talked about it a lot. It's like, oh, okay, let's lock, you know, so everyone comes in and you lock the door. They would play in a way that was completely freed from the usual confines. And, you know, when they've done that before, it's, you know, in sort of limited but exciting and notable historical circumstances, like the Ebbian Jam at Lemon Wheel, or like, you know, Big Cypress, or if you want to know the Jaded Bet perspective on it, I remember like 2011, right? Like, yeah. So shows were like early 3.0 shows were good. People were psyched. Everyone was happy. You know, it was like thrilled to be back. And there were like moments of like, you know, where it was just like clicking and sort of, you know, just like really awesome. But there was also a lot of like slog during those times, right? But then it's like, man, they play these sound checks. like the Bethel Wave. All these, and like the best things that they would play over the course of the total year were when were in soundcheck, right? Like, the thing that we needed to do at the time was like get a like a one-way screen that would go down that would visualize the audience and they could just like play as if no one were there, right? But that they'd see, you know, they'd see this like, you know, raging thing.
Well, but yeah, I like the idea of the long gig, and this is kind of, you're right, this is the long gig. Although Big Cypress, of course, was the long gig too.
Hello. I recall us hanging out a bit at Big Cypress.
Yes.
Good times.
Yes. Yeah. I hung out with a lot of people. Honestly, if you asked me what did I do in Big Cypress from moment to moment, I would have no idea.
Vast majority of times that they've kind of like stepped out and come up with big ideas, it's always like 10x the whatever I thought. You know, it's like you sit around like, well, what if they did this, and what if they did this, and what if they did this, and you know, they never quite hit those things, but they do something that you didn't think of.
Even
that
better.
Is, you know, because it's like they're pretty good at the fish.
Yeah. Exactly. And every festival tends to surprise me just how much fun they are and how good the music is. And I shouldn't be surprised. And yet that's kind of, again, the magic. And that's, yeah. I got to say, back to your book now. The Fish yeah. Companion, for those of you who don't know, it's an amazing book created by a fan organization called Mockingbird, mbird.org. So Philip is a volunteer in the Mockingbird organization, and he's been a volunteer for over 20 years. Isn't that right, Phil?
Yeah, like just short. I think I started doing stuff with them little after their inception, right around the island tour.
I just have to tell everyone who hasn't seen or read this book or looked at this book, if you are a fish fan or if you know a fish fan that would appreciate or needs a gift, this book is just so unbelievable. And it's one of those that it's in my family. It's on our table. And it, when someone cracks it open, they just sit there for 2 hours reading it. And it's unbelievable. And especially the weird thing for me, you know, I should know this stuff. And yet there's things I didn't know about my own songs. Funny things I learn all the time. For example, Squirming Coil has a reference to John Lennon, the shooting of John Lennon. I didn't know that, but Martin Acaster told me that's so I believe it is. And lots of stuff. Could you come up with what that is? I don't know what the reference is. I was going through the lyrics in my head. I don't think there is, but
no, you know, and it was one sort of trepidation and fear that I had when I was speaking with you. I was like, you know, this interview is going to be great unless Tom corners me on some like.
Well, I'm not going to try to corner you, but other things I've learned about songs, just as I was thumbing through just today before the interview, was pretty funny. You know, some interesting stuff about, and I know you know this, the origins for example of Rift's music. And I knew that it was loosely tied to the curtain or the width part of the curtain. Isn't that right?
Yeah,
but
it is.
Yeah, I also thought there was another piece of music that might have been substituted in there or something. But I was kind of, you know, I read that and I'm like, yeah, I know that stuff. What I didn't know and is mentioned in the book is that there's now a missing line in the lyrics. Because to me, I think I wrote them in pairs. And as far as I know, the band, you know, they sing them as call and answer pairs. So if there were a missing line, it would have to be two missing lines. And I thought I would notice that, but maybe not.
One of the things that we need to do, and when I say we need to do, it's like I'm kind of subjunctively, it's like one of the things that could be nice to do if a lot of people had a lot of time one day, is to really have lyrics sort of time evolved in the documentation, right? So for example, Tad plays a new song, right? And we say, oh, well, gee, is this Tom song? Is this a Steve song? You know, is it a Just a Trey song? And there's been a number of times I'm trying to like come up with, I think one of them might be Pigtail. Pigtail, just your pigtail, just your pigtail. But like, okay, so we get the lyrics, and then like iterating with you to like, I'll shoot you an email and say, hey, Tom, you know,
right.
Can you help me out with the lyrics? We want to publish the lyrics. And they'll always be like, oh, well, you know, you wrote it this way, and then Trace, you know, sung it this way, and it'll be a, you'll be, you know, a couple times you've been surprised, like, oh, like, so it would totally be cool at some point to sort of show that work, right? Like, oh, like, wow, this was the original, and this is how it sort of evolved over time. Because reflecting that stuff as it evolves is just something that, I don't know. I haven't done it.
No, I would like to do that for certain songs. I think, like, for the most part, the versions that the band sings are the ones that got arrived at for whatever reason. It's usually because Trey, in the cases of songs that he and I wrote, found it to be the best. And in most cases, he's right. But what you're talking about is where I was kind of surprised that something's missing, or there are some funny cases where I believed that maybe a word was mispronounced and then that became the song. And yeah, you're right. So there's stuff like that. I noticed you guys did not include lyrics this time. And that's a big decision you guys made. You left a lot of stuff out because there's just so much when you're talking about a fish history.
Yeah. Well, we had a big math problem, right? And I mean, it's the kind of problem that people want, but look, the total course of the development of all of this documentation from early 90, like, you know, like 91, 92, when we really started putting it together in terms of like a, you know, coherent file of set lists, all the way up until 2009, right before the, like, before the band reformed, like, everything was sort of accumulated in Word files, right? It's just a bunch of Word files, right? And so, and some of that was actually like presented online and so forth, but they were all flat files, right? And then when the band reformed, and in late 2008, as the economy was cratering, but like fish was coming back, so, you know, we built the new, what people know as the sort of new current FishNet website, which involved taking all of that data and putting it into relational databases that could serve modern websites and serve application programming interfaces and, you know, drive iPhone apps or all of the great things that come from having information in a relational database, right?
Right.
So we did that. And when we did that, it was great, and it was a lot of work, and, you know, it had a lot of really cool utility, but it also created this limitlessness. there was no limit to what we could annotate about the fish experience over time. And the, you know, the sort of type A go-getting geeks that we are, we took that space and ran with it, right?
Yes.
And so everything exploded. I mean, you know, the teases exploded. The, you know, we got really good at what we were doing too, right, over the course of time. It's like,
right.
I mean, you know, not tooting our own horn about like the quality of the work, but I mean, in terms of the process of accumulating data and sort of analysis about the band Fish,
yeah,
we had that down.
You guys were experts, and now you had a limitless relational database you could just keep piling info into.
Right, which is great. And really doesn't, there's really no downside, right? Until such point where you want to stuff it back into a book.
Right. If you want to tell someone, if you want to sit down and tell someone the entire story, and I mean entire story about fish, that's kind of what you guys decided to do in volumes 1 and 2 of The Fish Companion.
Yeah. The first two volumes were kitchen sink editions, right? It's like every reasonable fact that we could accumulate about the band that, you know, that made any sense whatsoever, and some which was only, you know, sort of on the verge of coherency, made it into the first two books, right? And but those two experiences were interesting, you know, I mean, first of all, they took place a long time ago, right? I mean, this is back in the day, but that sort of you know, and we, like, the people that put it together didn't have any particular, you know, we were all kind of smart folks, you know, more or less. But we didn't have any like skills in doing this, right? There was nobody who like, you know, like we weren't book publishers and we weren't, you know, writers per se.
Right.
And one of the interesting things, I mean, a lot of the, you know, some of the folks who sort of got cut their teeth doing this stuff when they were in college and shortly thereafter, like Jeremy Goodwin, for example,
yes,
right, I mean, have gone on to, you know, pretty accomplished careers.
Become actual writers or journalists.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
So the first two were all about accumulation. And this one was, oh, shit, we have way, way, way too much stuff.
Was the first two, would you characterize them loosely as, here is every single show that Phish played, here's every single song that they played in those shows, and here's a few reviews and pictures along the timeline, and boom, let's binder it up, and that's the book.
No, but maybe it kind of seemed that way. There was a lot more to those books too. I mean, there was the sideshows. I mean, like, for example, one of the things that we've documented extensively that doesn't get quite the sort of notoriety is the documentation of the sideshows. I mean, we like, you know, every single appearance by any member of Phish in any musical context whatsoever is documented on our site.
Oh, right? That's right.
And a lot of them are, I mean, you know, so a lot of that is kind of pretty well known, or, you know, it's like, okay, well, it's Tab shows or, you know, Mike shows and so forth and so on, all the various, you know,
Trey
individual
Carnegie Hall or whatever. Right.
Sure. 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 Like all of that stuff is present. But I mean, every time that they've sat in, I mean, and those stories are fascinating because it really kind of goes, it reflects both the influence of and influence exerted by the band, right? In terms of, you know, the people they would sit in with and so forth. And none of that stuff made in the book, right?
Right.
Like that was something that was particularly like heartbreaking for me at the beginning. I was like, you know, wait a minute, we're going to do this whole book. We're not doing any sideshows. I mean, we did like a little bit. We did kind of in order to create the continuity and fill in the years in which Phish wasn't an active entity. You know, we have section on the hiatus, and we have section on the breakup that sort of, you know, walks through major contours of that. But I mean, there are, you know, there's almost as many records of shows by members of Phish that aren't Phish, right? as there are Phish shows, and none of that got any play. There's just so many things that we, you know, could have done but didn't, including lyrics, including, you know, like the jam charts and the stats and so forth, all of which, you know, could be topics for additional books. I mean,
right.
One of the things that I was really hopeful to sort of convey in this is if any of the readers out there and fans who sort of looked at this book have ever sat back and said, you know, why didn't they do this, man? Or like, man, wouldn't it have been awesome if they would have included, you know, X or Y or Z? And the answer to almost all of those hypotheticals is, you know, yeah. I mean, Phish is a rich, diverse, you know, experience, and they've produced a lot of, you know, amazing music and experiences to talk about virtually endlessly, and people do so, you know, with aplomb on the intertrons there. So, you know, like the lyrics, I'd love nothing more than to sit back to do. I mean, I think that a really great book, you know, we've talked about this in the past, would be like a coffee table book of annotated, you know,
yeah,
Tom
it's kind of the it's been always suggested. Everyone who sort of gets me talking about lyrics brings that up, like, why haven't you come up with the coffee table book? That'd be beautiful art, maybe lizards climbing on the lyrics, and maybe it could follow, like you were talking about, the evolution of the lyrics. Like this song Bug actually came from two separate poems, or this song Winter Queen, here's the original photo of when Trey and I wrote it, overlooking the Hudson River in a really, really sunny room, where we happened to take pictures, one of the few times we took photos of the entire songwriting session. Probably interesting, but as you guys faced, I mean, when you look at the number of people involved in your book, and you wound up, even after cutting, like you said, way more than half of the information out, you wound up with a 900-page book. I think lyrics, to me, would be such an overwhelming job to do it right and to do it well. that it's almost sort of better for people to find lyrics and discussions and stuff like that online these days, in a way.
Yeah, well, you don't want to give away the store, and you've always been really good about that, I think, is like maintaining, you know, like you, because you're open and accessible and talk to folks who like, you know, which is like, seems like a normal thing for me to say, but like, that's not necessarily common among people who are major contributors to bands that are sort of, you know, writing history. Right. So, but you're accessible yet without giving away the secret. Let people come up with their own stories.
Well, that is my other, that's sort of the hidden issue, is, as you're alluding to, I don't like the spoon feeding. If that can be left out, then great. Maybe someday there'll be a coffee table book, but I don't like telling people this is what this one's really about.
Sure. No, totally. One of the things that's really interesting issue and concern too, is just given all the possibilities of what books could be, right? Like that this book wasn't, how we carved it out, actually it was a pretty nice way to do so. And it really kind of captured a lot of the experience and a lot of good writing.
Yep. You nailed it.
But that being said, right, like I'm always thinking about the future, right? Looking forward to what is it about the Phish experience that is interesting to write about and interesting to read about, but more importantly, in a way that can be done viably, right?
Right.
Like financially viably, because people don't read anymore.
That's kind of the weirdest subtext that I was wondering if you were going to get to, is that I have a family of people that read often, but all the reading is done these days on the internet. There's very few books around, which is kind of sad to me. I'm a huge, every book that I read, I usually like to keep and buy. I'm not like a borrower. And so then I'll stuff them in a case somewhere so that chronologically I can like go down to the basement and go like 4 years back and see what I was reading back then. And,
totally.
And hope it's not too much Harry Potter or Tom Clancy or something.
Well, I mean, it's a thing, right? And the reason that it's a thing is because of the economics of book publishing, right? Like there may well be a sufficient market to have mass kind of like, you know, publisher published books about Phish that do well. It hasn't happened, right, in a long, long time, but it could happen.
Yeah.
Like we did well, but we did well because we did it ourselves, right?
Yes.
And that was a, you know, I mean, it required a lot of heavy lifting from not many people. Sort of, we had to sort of go in the tank and really learn a lot of things. And this, and it took a lot. It took a long time because we had to sort of climb that curve. I mean, the first two books were published by publishers and we were like, wait a minute, you know, like we did okay, but we're looking to maximize funds to give away, right?
Yes.
We're like highly profit motivated in order so that we can accumulate the most money so that we may give it away for charity.
Yeah. And let's talk about that for a second, just so that that's not lost.
Yeah.
So every single penny that comes out of the sales of this book goes into charities that fund music education. Is that correct?
Yeah, all the net proceeds. Cost money to print it, cost money to ship it. We retained a design firm that, you know, like one of the things that was really, really important to us in the book was that it not look like a phone book. All the folks who are the core volunteers who folks have sort of come to know over the years from the Mockingbird Foundation, all of the names in the book that you see are people who contributed all their time, right? And so the totality of the net proceeds, I think we have like 97% of received funds go directly to charitable grants.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's so wonderful. Do you guys publish those numbers? Do you happen to know any numbers that we could tell my podcast audience about money that's gone out to charities from this book?
From the book, not specifically. We did this year as a foundation pass the $1 million mark in total funds that have been raised and distributed over the course of our history.
Oh my God.
So,
that's great.
You know, we're going to do, I mean, this book in particular is going to do really well, and it's going to really do really well because of the fact that we did it on our own. And, you know, just a little bit of news to drop on that is that we've actually sold out of our allocation. There are still a few books to be had. And when I say a few, I mean a few. There are, I think there's like 100 or 200 at Dry Goods, and there's 100 or 200 at Amazon is my understanding. But the total allocation, I mean, like if you go to, if you, I'd love to be able to give the pitch of, hey, go to thefishcompanion.com and order your book. But doing so would be fake news because you can't get the book there because we've sold out.
That would be an alternative fact. So why don't we tell people get the last 100 at Amazon and to search for The Fish Companion, a guide to the band and their music, third edition. And we've kind of danced around describing the book. Do you want to do that, Philip? I mean, I can give you a brief description. Tons of beautiful, beautiful photos, color, black and white, stunning photos of all festivals and notable concerts kind of open up, just give you sort of almost a chronological idea of Fish's progression. Very, very beautiful. And then it seems that the way that you have approached it is you kind of divide it up into... well, it's definitely chronological, but you've divided Fish up into at least six, maybe eight eras. And each of those gets an artist and a separate color coded tab in a way. And it's beautiful, phenomenal.
Thank you. Well, you know, its beauty was by design. We retained, you know, this firm, J2 Design, and I want to mention Kara Cox, who was the lead designer and saved me and our readers from all of my bad design ideas that she stood up for and said, no, we're not going to do it that way. But yeah, so it is chronological. It's really in three sections. We've sort of, as a fandom, have come to accept the sort of three major eras of Fish as being delineated by the markings in which they didn't perform, right? So you had the totality of time up until the hiatus in September 2000, and then which was 1.0, and then you had sort of 2.0 when they came back at the end of 2002 up until Coventry and their unfortunate, though quite necessary and appropriate in retrospect, demise in the summer of 2004, and then 2009 to present, which would be 3.0, right?
Right.
There was sort of two, there's like, just like Fish, this book even has eras. It took so long, right? So like the first era of the book, which was like 2012 to late 2015, was sort of a group of folks who were not me and off sort of trying to put it together, which was really, I mean, putting together a book is hard. And one of the things that they did was to further divide up the eras into sub eras. And so there was like 1.1 and like 1.0 and 1.1 and 1.2 and like 2.0, you know, like 3.1, 3.2. And one of the things that we did when the kind of new regime showed up at the end of 2015, we wanted some sort of like logical divisions, and we liked the intros, right? Like the intros were good and the art was amazing, and we weren't getting rid of the art.
So you just divided it into years, kind of. You just sort of did 2 year chunks or 3 year chunks.
If any of the artwork that precedes each chapter particularly strikes a fancy among any of your listeners, you can go to bottleneckgallery.com and purchase them. And some of them will have the original sort of like never even made it into the book numbering. So you can like get a poster that says, you know, Fish like 1.2.
The posters preceding every chapter, and I'm thumbing through it right now as you were talking, because I kind of didn't really realize how they are delineated, but there are color-coded tabs that you can see when you close the book. And right now I just happen to open to the gold one, which is at the very top, it's labeled Fish 2.0. And obviously this is the only one in 2.0. So 2002 to 2004. Yep. And then the very next one is red, and it's at the top, of course, says Fish 3.0. And it's 2009 through 2011. So it's kind of like bite-sized chunks. And as you go through, you see venues, concerts, you see reviews for particular shows or festivals, and there's a couple photos, there's a couple highlights here and there, and beautiful song histories. That's the part I like. And again,
that's the part I like.
Yeah, and another one, here's a good one. So again, Martin Acaster.
Acaster.
Oh, he's just Acaster. He's not the caster yet.
Marty Acaster, fantastic dude, longtime friend of mine, and really eloquent song historian.
He's able to tell me that that sand. Yeah, I love his song descriptions. He said on the surface it's a statement about gun control, but he said if you go a little bit deeper, you realize that it's sort of talking about our entire existence as parasites on the planet. I don't know if I knew that, but I like it. And I'm going to say that he's right, because that's what I say when people ask me what songs are about.
That's awesome. Yeah, you know, Marty's a darn good writer. And one of the things, one of the sort of conundrums and challenges that we had when constructing the book was, for example, Marty would add really interesting, vibrant, timely, and meticulously researched historical sort of context and of all sorts of songs. And you can find all of this stuff in the sort of original song histories on fish.net.
Right.
But we had this math problem, right?
Yes. Yes.
So we couldn't get it all in, right? We couldn't get even a small fraction of it all in. And so if it wasn't about fish, it didn't matter how interesting or relevant or exciting to the reader it might have been, a lot of that shit just hit the cutting room floor because it just had to. And let me tell you, it was just painful because those are the types of sort of, intellectual sort of flights of fancy and road trips that stem from a single line of a fish lyric or a particular event of a show that really add to the experience. At least it has for me.
Yeah.
And it's made it such like those are the things that sort of,
that's hard to cut in, because it's the color sometimes in a way. That's the stuff that you want to read. And you're saying sort of by necessity, you had to, if it's not directly about fish, you had to cut some of those beautiful stories.
I mean, another way to cut this book, right, is say, I say this not just theoretically, because I'm always sort of thinking about if we get another bite at this apple, what's the best way, right? And I can totally see making a fantastic book using the fish experience as sort of just historical anchors to talk about the world, right? And
I think you just answered my question about everyone who wants me to write a lyric coffee table book. Maybe that's the book that you guys... I'll get you guys to write it.
Maybe. I mean, I won't press you on the air, but whenever you come around to thinking that a coffee table book of lyrics is going to be good, give us a ring. We can help.
Well, that's amazing. I'd like to drift back to the book, in summary. And one thing that sort of caught in my mind is something I needed to ask you about. As the allocation diminishes, and I'm hoping that a whole lot of people run to Amazon.com to get the last 100. And where was the other 100 hiding?
There's some at Dry Goods.
Those two places pretty much are it. Then what happens? Do you guys go into a second printing?
No, I don't think that we're going to do it. I will be sure not to speak definitively because these things are always sort of under discussion. No, we're not going to do a second printing of the book. And that's really because of economics. I think that we could sell additional books, but you have to print so many, right?
Saying that will create a run because I really want to tell people this is a masterpiece. What I'm holding in my hand is this amazing, amazing work of art. And you should be proud. You are a co-editor. Is that right? The main editor?
Marco Walsh, who's the president of the Mockingbird Foundation, really handled the business end, and I sort of took a lead on the editorial end with the invaluable assistance of and participation of a team of people who were, you know, really fundamentally partners. But I played point guard, made sure the shit got done.
Yep, well, it got done. And now you spoke for all the Jaded Vets earlier. I'm going to speak for the entire fish community. We thank you for putting in so much volunteer time to this project. I'm also going to urge my listeners to grab these last copies, because once they're gone, they're gone. And again, this is called The Fish Companion, A Guide to the Band and Their Music, 3rd edition, and you won't go wrong by getting one of these or getting one for a friend. Philip, thank you very, very much for talking with me today. I think it was incredible.
Thank you, Tom. You have a really interesting thing going here with the podcast, and it really presents a unique and, for me, treasured opportunity to sort of turn the tables and just really appreciate your support and friendship over the years. So
yeah, thanks, man. Absolutely. So thanks so much, Phil. And thanks for the kind words about Under the Scales. See you soon. Thank you.
Thanks, buddy. See you on the road.
Hello, listeners. Philip is a great guy, as you could hear, and an even greater fan for volunteering so much time to benefit the fish community. He only asked me one favor when we were recording this episode, and I blew it. I forgot to ask him to name some of the people who helped him getting the Fish Companion Volume 3 done. So I asked him to send me a statement, which I'll read now. This book reflects ongoing work of the Mockingbird Foundation that consists of dozens of volunteers, but the heavy lift took place over a group me during a 10-week period in the winter of 2016. In addition to myself, so that's Philip, and co-editor Marco Walsh, the core working group for the book consisted of Martin Acaster, hey Martin, Chris Bertolette, hi Chris, John Demeter, Herschel Gelman, Chris Glushko, Jeremy Goodwin, Scott Marks, hi Scott, Dan Milecars, Steve Paolini, Dan Purcell, Tanya Sperry, Tim Wade, and Jeremy Welsh. Special thanks to contributing artists and photographers, including Andrea Nusinoff, hi Andrea, Dave Van, AJ Masthay, and Nate Duval, among many others. For the full credits and more about the book origins and foundation history, check out the book's preface and intro. So that's the statement. Heartfelt thanks to all those awesome people. And then lastly, for me, this actually makes a huge difference for other people discovering my podcast. I'm trying to pump up my Apple numbers. If you Apple listeners haven't done it yet, either on the podcast app on your iPhone or iTunes on your Mac, please subscribe to Under the Scales and rate and review me. Even a 5-word review. This podcast rocks my world. Or this podcast rocks. That's 3 words. All right. Thanks, everybody. Back next week.